morning and welcome to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and it's 11 a.m. Central Time, and it's Wednesday, and we're coming to you every Wednesday morning, 11 a.m. Central Time until 1 p.m. And today we're going to cover some of the topics that I've been dealing with recently, but there's a couple of newspaper articles that have made and issues that have made the news even in the last couple of days. One is the North Korean test firing of six missiles, and an earlier report earlier in the week on the U.S. Navy's use of underwater sonars. And actually, these two issues are tied together. You know, we covered the underwater sonars probably, what, 3-4 weeks ago now. And, you know, this whole issue of this sort of new movement in terms of what underwater sonars can do and the purpose behind them really ultimately is this issue of silent submarines, which has come up periodically. And the Koreans, Iranians, and others are pointed to as potential, potential players as far as silent submarines, having submarines that can come very close into the coastal areas of the United States and our allies and be able to effectively launch, a short range or medium range, missile. And what they've been testing are not just the medium range missiles now, but also attempting at least a long range missile. Now, you know, the whole rogue nation issue goes back even further, and you know, the issue started making a lot of play when national missile defense became, you know, a major issue for the United States and our allies back during the Clinton administration. And that was around the time that we were reporting on the HAARP story, because that was part of that whole missile defense initiative in terms of being able to really safeguard against any nation. And, you know, the HAARP issue has come and gone and continues to come back because they've advanced the site, continue to advance the missile defense systems, and there's reasons for that. And it's a question of not disallowing all of these technologies, but really taking a look at the ones that we need and which ones can be operated safely, and in what way can they be operated safely. You know, HAARP as a missile defense system may be, in fact, extremely effective, but it also has other applications that, you know, have present certain risks. And people can go back, and if you're listening for the first time, you can go back to the archive programs on HAARP and kind of get an overview of that issue. The same is true on the underwater sonar. So here's the story in the news on the sonars. On the 1st of July, the Los Angeles Times guy, Tony Perry, reported the U.S. Navy was going to use their sonars in exercises in the area of Hawaii, naval exercises. And what's happened over the last several years is almost every one of these naval exercises has been associated with the beachings of various species of whales or marine mammals. And the reason for this, and, you know, the marine mammal issue is, you know, certainly one issue, but, you know, when you look at what's going on, why is that happening? And does it affect other, you know, sea life, and in what ways does it affect it? And the sonars are a major, major new initiative in terms of a military and national defense. The silent submarines are what's driving it, and rogue nations such as Korea and Iran with now nuclear capability are certainly, you know, creating a situation where we're, again, looking at the trade-off of national security versus what might be lost or risked. In this case, marine mammals are a risk. People are going, well, you know, maybe that's a risk we can stand, maybe it isn't. But it's beyond that, because the way these sonars work, the way sound operates in water, and these are active sonars, so they kick out a very strong sound signal, and the way sound reacts in water is much, much different than in air. And in fact, when you look at sound in terms of the oceans, and we'll get into that right after the break. This is a good explanation, explains what's going on there, and then we can take it and tie it into today's news. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World, and we're talking about the latest in technology. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live. And it's Wednesday, and this program is every Wednesday at 11 a.m. till 1 p.m., so please pass the word on and tune in. Today we're talking, opening up the program, just talking a little bit about the situation in North Korea, as well as tying in this issue of sonars, the underwater sonars, the new active sonars. And let me go back to this situation with what does sound do in the seas and how does it react differently. You know, essentially sonars are sort of replicating what nature does, trying to copy and mimic nature in a way that allows us some of the same possibilities. In the case of marine mammals, the way they actually communicate is using low frequency and high frequency sounds, but sounds that actually get trapped in salt layers. When you look at the ocean and the variations in temperature as you get deeper into the seas, it gets cooler and cooler. There's a certain layer where actually sound gets trapped, just like a radio signal. People listening to shortwave today on other parts around the country and around the world get it because the radio wave, the shortwave, actually bounces between a layer above the Earth called the ionosphere and the Earth itself, and it gets trapped and it goes around the curvature of the Earth, and you consequently hear the sound. In the oceans, sound signals, acoustic waves, actually get trapped by salt layers, and they travel thousands of miles. This is the way whales actually communicate. They can communicate hundreds, even up to 1,000 miles, just with the sound that they can generate, you know, as an animal. So what happens with active sonars is we utilize that information and the physics of how sound reacts in water, and we push the sound signal out, and then we measure that sound signal, and then we can triangulate and locate things under the seas with a great deal of efficiency. The problem is the amount of energy that we're using. And in these tests that have been run, they've been using mid-range sonars, which are already permitted around the world, as well as the newer sonars, which actually were the subject of a huge lawsuit a number of years ago. That was won with one caveat, and it was interesting because I've talked about it since that case was theoretically won, is the caveat is that they'll only use it in Asia, which is kind of ridiculous because it travels everywhere, and they'll only use it during times of war, which again was sort of ridiculous because when they settled it, at least this administration considered us in that time of war, so they've been continuing to use it regardless. So the same group brought a lawsuit. They brought it and they actually won a stay. This reported in yesterday's paper in San Diego. They stopped the military from testing this further or using it in their exercises. But here's what happens to that energy in the oceans. When it strikes a marine mammal or a human being or any animal that would have a gas pocket, and almost every fish species, anyone that's been out fishing and has cleaned a fish knows that in the intestinal tract of almost all, the digestive tract of almost all fish, you've got gas pockets. Well, what happens when the sound strikes a human being, say, in the air or any other living organism in the air, most of that energy, like 99.97% of the energy bounces or is reflected away. But things are a lot different in water. When you're immersed in the oceans, when that sound wave strikes the body of a human or a marine mammal or any fish species, 100%, all of the energy is absorbed into that tissue and transfers through that tissue until it hits a cavity like the lung cavities, nasal passages, or the gas pockets in the intestinal tract of many fish species, and they explode. The energy gets released dramatically at that point. You get massive hemorrhaging in the analysis of the fish that have made it drifted into shore and then beached. They've noted exactly that kind of problem. Now, the Navy a few years ago acknowledged their responsibility, but they suggested it was because it scared the fish and the mammals, and they ran to the surface and they experienced the bend, which gives you the same effect, and it's a ridiculous claim. A look at the physics of the sound in water explains it quite clearly. Anyway, those are the sonars made it in the news again in recent days. This is why this continues to come up and why the United States continues to violate really what is, in fact, standing order on this. But, you know, the problem is it's security versus the risk. And, you know, people need to make that decision. People are making that decision. And part of the purpose of this program is to get some of these issues out there so at least we have an opportunity to talk about it. You know, these technologies could probably be replaced with others that would be just as effective for locating those silent submarines. Again, it's a question of you know, which way do you want the technology to go, and what are the trade-offs? The fact is, there's lots of alternatives. You know, when you look at technology and the way it impacts us today, you know, and that's been really on my heart the last 12 years. You know, we've reported on technology issues over the last 12 years and in radio forums and published articles, books, videos, lots of material we've put out trying to condense information down, make it readily available. And, you know, part of that has been setting up the layinstitute.org website. And if you check that out at layinstitute.org, that site is where our research archives are being loaded. All the materials that we pull out and we quote on this program and another published material will actually make it on that site. So eventually all of the data is there and people can source it pretty easily. There's a thing called EPI search, and if you go there, you can do word searches on all of the topics that we cover, including these we're covering today. And there's about 700 documents loaded, and there's 20,000 more over the next several years that we'll be loading in addition to what we collect each month, which is quite a bit, as a matter of fact. You know, the other site I want to draw people's attention to today is the earthpulse.com site. That's my commercial website where books, videos, articles, published material is available on these topics and a lot of others, and people are welcome to take those articles and circulate them, get them out there to people that might be able to use that information, and we encourage you to do that. Again, that's earthpulse.com. earthpulse.com. And we also have a toll-free for today's program if you want to get in on the conversation. And it's 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. And we have Don in Ohio who's hanging on, it looks like. Are you still there, Don?
Yes, I am.
All right, go ahead. You had a question or a comment?
Yeah, actually, you were talking about the sonar and stuff like that, and I want to bring up something that happened that not too many people really put together as being something that should have been put together. Is after the tsunami hit in December of 19, what was that? What year was it? I'm not sure even.
2005, I believe, or maybe 2006, actually. No, you got to go back even further, 2004. We're going the wrong direction. Yeah, you're right.
Years. And soon after that, they said that the USS San Francisco had to lump back to San Juan, or it was not San Juan, Guam, I think, where it was based at and stuff like that, because it was badly damaged because it hit a mountain. And no one seems to put those two together, because this happened like 12 days after the tsunami. But, you know, who's to say where the USS San Francisco was when the tsunami actually happened?
And, yeah.
I mean, considering that we're already supposed to have the most, revered sonar and stuff like that,
right,
that they didn't see this mountain, I mean, that's crap. So what really happened?
Yeah, you know, it's a big question, you know. The idea that... you know, our sonars are extremely efficient. I mean, you might as well have vision, you know, include of what you see above with your own eye, you know, what the new technologies can do under the seas. You know, the big issue isn't so much the fact that we need the imaging. It's the way in which we collect the data, and there's lots of ways to get imaging, good imaging these days, even through the seas. And this is where, you know, sort of a look at the technologies and their impacts, and the problem is, it's this whole relationship between new sources of energy that we're introducing that are coherent or measurable in a way that is rhythmic, and these actually sometimes line up with energy codes or what I would call frequency codes that the body understands and begins to react to. So there's more than just the gross impact of an acoustic wave in the sea. It's this whole idea of, you know, what are the best ways, to use technology, and what are the impacts of it. In this case, we know some of those impacts, and yet it's not really being factored in terms of how we fund these projects versus how we fund maybe other alternatives that give us the same technology yield, which is, you know, good intelligence for silent submarines, which we need in this country.
Do you have any idea if any of the crew members on the USS San Francisco at that time have been put under gag order?
You know, I don't know. It would be interesting, you know, but generally, you know, submarine crews are pretty much, what goes on within submarine crews is pretty much classified anyway. I mean, once they're out and they're on their missions, whatever happens along the way, isn't something where, you know, we generally get access to. And like you say, what are the odds of them running into a mountain? I mean, you would have to be literally asleep at the wheel, I mean, to have that happen. And I don't see that either. And there's too many systems that back up these systems on, you know, on our military vessels. So I don't see that as really the story, more of the cover story for what else might have happened. And, you know, this is pretty common, you know, in terms of, you know, military has a right to contain the news because they control the news. I don't think it's necessarily a good idea all the time. There's not enough accountability, not enough oversight. You know, you have the intelligence committees of the Congress, but how many congressmen have scientific backgrounds where they can even ask the right questions, much less know whether or not they're being given reasonable answers? And this is part of the oversight problem, quite frankly. And you know, my dad was in the Congress back in the early 70s. I can tell you, he was no scientist, and on these issues, he would have struggled. It would have been a dramatic thing for him to be able to understand it and see it, because he didn't have the background, and most politicians don't.
There was another strange thing that was said at the time, too, is that...
Hold on, Don. We're coming up to a break. We'll take it right after the break. And you're listening to RBN Live. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and this is Changing the Way We See the World. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And, Don, are you still hanging in there with me?
Yes, I am.
All right, go ahead. You were just getting ready to say something.
Yeah, they said that it wasn't on their maps, but it was on the Russian maps that they had, you know, had it located on their maps. So, you know, what is it that, you know, I mean, the Russians are now, you know, giving us their maps, but, you know, I mean, seems awful strange anyways.
Well, I mean, it is. It's one of those stories. You know, maybe one of these days we'll hear the rest of the story. It's a lot of these come and go in the news. You know, one of the things we've done over the years is, you know, we keep track of those kinds of details, because sooner or later, you know, other things come out. You know, a project I've just been working on. In fact, just before we went on today, one of the folks in there producing this program this morning, Kelly, was saying, you know, what are you working on? And I'm working on this. Finishing a book where I've gone back to the 1920s and traced sort of the technologies in one area all the way up to the present frame. And, you know, when you start to look at things over a long period of time, much more gets unraveled, and maybe we'll unravel that not down the road. Don, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. We'll watch that story, see what else comes out. Maybe something will eventually. The, you know, talking about the sonars again, you know, what's the motivation behind the silent sonars and why the military insists on moving forward is, you know, this is an area we know, first we know it will work, we know what the risks are, we know what the losses are, potentially, but we know it'll work. And at a time when, you know, when there's a couple of countries out there at least that have said, even in recent days, I mean, that was the thing with the Korean missile launch, you know, there's been this, supposedly this six-way talk with a madman that hasn't yielded much, and in a very kind of in-your-face move on the 4th of July, he launches six missiles just to illustrate the point that there is no conversation or negotiations, and there isn't. You know, negotiations by tyrants are looked at as a good way to stall to get done what they need to get done, and that's what's happened, and now we're in this very, very tenuous position, and you see both in the case of Iran and in the case of North Korea, we're in a very risky situation, and hopefully cool heads will prevail, because it has the potential of exploding dramatically out of control, you know, and who knows, you know, that those things remain to be seen, but, you know, those are the things in the current news, and why this is such a touchy issue, and the fight back and forth really is more than an environmental issue, it's that whole issue of national security and relevant technology, and that's that therein lies the challenge. You know, the project I've been working on the last couple of years has been one I've been drafting for a long time, and I'm going to get into that during the course of this next couple of hours. But right now we've got Rita in Colorado. Rita, are you there?
Oh, hi, it's me again. I was just thinking that I could probably help you get out of the box a little bit. I know so many people with like political aspirations have to think about national security a little more than some of us that can think about, well, you know, what is so much safer about having no nuclear missiles on the land, but having these submarines going around, you know, with nuclear missiles in them, you know.
Right.
And so, we've got to think about, like, a world without submarines. You know, think about it. What are they for? They're really obscene, offensive machines that go around and threaten other people. You know, they're offensive. They're not, you know, really, defending things. They're good at sneaking up on somebody and launching a missile, you know, and blowing up somebody's city somewhere.
Well, you know, I that's exactly what they were designed to do. I mean, they were designed to do that. And the fact is, they're in everybody's arsenal at the present time. You know, the argument, I don't disagree with it, was developed for defensive purposes. The problem is actually affecting it. We can't even affect reasonable assurances on the existing disarmament. But, you know, there are things that can be done. You know, with good imaging systems, for instance, that are safe, you can determine where they all are. So that's pretty easy to isolate. It's just a question of, you know, are people interested in taking that next step? And right now, we're so far from that dialogue, and it's unfortunate, but that is, in fact, where we're at. You know, my view of where the technologies are going is some of them are so proliferated now that the chances of putting the genie back in the bottle, it's not going to happen. And in atomic and nuclear technologies, it's pretty complicated. But there's other technologies that are advancing much more rapidly that have equal or maybe even greater, more devastating potential in terms of their impact on anyone that they would be used against. And yet these technologies don't require the multi-billion-dollar investments that atomic weapons and nuclear weapons do. You know, almost the cost prohibits a lot of the activity, but it's real. I mean, the stuff is going on. These people have developed technologies, and people are going to continue to develop technologies. The biggest concern today is who gets there first. You know, I mean, we've introduced some new concepts in the way weapons and the directions of weapons technologies today are to get to energy-based systems that are literally at the speed of light, which means in the context of things like preemptive war, you've got a whole different concept. Even submarines become obsolete in that environment because you're talking about you being able to hit a target at a speed that you could send the signal or that laser around the Earth.
Yeah, think about paradigm shifts where, you know, maybe we'll be able to see those things. You know, they're all pretending they're silent, but...
Yeah,
I mean,
on.
We've got Star Wars technology. We can find those suckers, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Hold on, Rita. We'll come right back after the break and take that one on, because there is a lot of technology out there. We should get into it. This is Dr. Nick Begich. You're listening to RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. And Rita, are you still with me?
Yeah. So,
okay, go ahead.
So you know, my idea is, you know, the problem is probably going to be there are a lot of countries that got a lot of investment in these things, you know, and they built up their arsenals and their navies. So we've got to think, you know, if we're going to have a paradigm shift, we've got to say, okay, we're going to get rid of submarines, but we'll leave your battleships, okay? You guys can still have battleships, but everybody's going to get rid of submarines because we're going to know where all of them are. And we're going to get rid of them all at the same time, and everybody's going to say, "Yeah, we're going to get rid of all the submarines," and they're going to all bring them into docks because they're going to know we're going to be able to find them, we're going to see them, and we won't need them anymore. You know, anybody that wants to do a Jacques Cousteau kind of thing can do it with submersibles. You know, we don't need submarines. Period. You don't need them.
Well, you know, it's again that whole idea that after the Cold War we were supposed to have a dividend for peace, and what we got was a dividend for Wall Street because we spent more money on companies related to the military-industrial complex than ever before. You know that, you know, could that ever happen? I hope so. I hope one day that we see the day that, you know, that can really happen and resource can be put differently. You know, there's another issue with submarines. It doesn't get much media. It did a few years ago, but the story kind of went away, but it still hasn't, the problem hasn't gone away, which is the old Soviet submarine fleet. A lot of that is up in the Arctic Ocean and those submarines with nuclear cores. The cores have been pulled and put on land, but they're not encased in anything. They're just sort of leaking into the environment. And actually, the problem there is it's become a huge problem. It was reported by the Bologna Foundation in Europe. The guy who first disclosed the story in Russia was jailed for like 10 months for treason and finally released. I met folks from the Bologna Foundation lecturing. We lectured together in Brussels, actually, a number of years ago on Arctic issues. And, you know, this whole concept of sort of what's left over from the Cold War is, you know, is really a big issue. You know, submarines and their legacy, not just in terms of, you know, what they can do today, but, you know, what's happening with the ones that are left over. You know, when you look at the biggest messes in the United States in terms of cleanups are all related to the atomic and nuclear industry or left over from the Cold War. And, you know, it's part of the, you know, part of that trade-off. But at the same time, you know, we should be smarter, wiser, more careful with how those trade-offs are made in the future. You know, the trade-off on sonars, the type of sonars that are being advanced is maybe as much as a third or more of the life in the sea, which then changes all of the life in the sea and everyone that depends upon the sea for life, which is everyone on the planet. So you start to look at, you know, what are we capable of today? And it's much more than nuking a city. Now we can have the possibility of really laying waste to the whole planet's systems. And from my perspective, and I think the perspective of many, the active sonars, when they were first posed back in the 50s, even our Cold War adversaries said, okay, we'll all agree we're not going to do this because we know the result. Well, you know, technologies have advanced and the interest in this has changed again back the other direction. But the conditions that kept us all out of it in the first place haven't changed, and that's the actual devastation to one of the systems that drives life on this planet and that we, quite frankly, cannot do without. A third of the sea life would literally devastate the United States as much as any other country.
Yeah, well, I really think that the military people will go for it if we tell them this thing the right way. You know, you think about it, if you're going to invade a country, you don't want to invade a country with submarines, you know. But you can say, well, we're going to go back. You can still have your gunboats, and you're going to stare down your enemy gun turret to gun turret. You know, and if you want to liberate some country somewhere, they'll see us coming in, you know?
Yeah.
But we're not going to be sneaking in, blowing up some city. I'm sure that when, you know, Britain bombed Kabul with their Trident, I don't think they really, you know, won a lot of friends in Afghanistan for that, you know?
Right. Reed, I appreciate the call. You know, the issues that, you know, the issues of national defense and, again, safety, security, it's always the big trade-offs. There was a quote, I just reread it recently. It was by William Cohen when he was Secretary of Defense, and he raised it during discussions in the 90s about international terrorism and sort of where that was going. And, you know, we've seen where it's gone. But our response to it, in my opinion, has gotten very disproportionate. You know, when you think about terrorism, certainly it's a threat, like many threats that we deal with as Americans every day. And it's responsible, including all the deaths in this so-called war for Iraq's freedom. You know, it's probably 5,000-6,000 Americans have died as a result of this, and many, many, many more have been hurt and injured. And that's a lot of death. That's a lot of injury. But when you compare it, for instance, say over the same 10-year period to something that happens every day, medical malpractice in the United States kills over the same 10-year period 1 million Americans, and yet we give it very little attention, and certainly not the $500 billion or more that it's going to cost to complete this effort in Iraq, in Afghanistan. And, you know, that we have 800 military bases scattered around the country. We're the biggest game in town. There hasn't been a power like the United States is today since the Roman Empire. And then with that comes, I believe, a great deal of responsibility for each American, because it's a government, theoretically at least, by the people, for the people, and of the people, which means that we're obligated to understand a little bit about the technologies that make government strong in the 21st century. And that's part of the hope of this program, is to get those issues that really define us, which is technology. I mean, as a nation, we're defined by the technology that we can wield in terms of our power internationally and productively. And if you look around the world, you can see it in terms of where and how power is distributed. And today, the very technologies that we're discussing have the potential to liberate us in incredible ways or entrap us. You know, the idea of being able to image the seas, for instance, and being able to image everything virtually. We have the type of imaging capability now where you can't hide anything on this planet. It's a question of, you know, here we go. You know, they're actually doing that. Now, there's a big trade-off there as well, as where is safety and security trade-off for personal privacy and liberty. And this is, you know, this was the topic of last week's show for those that want to go back to it. You know, the privacy issues as they relate to sort of where all the technology goes and then how the debate is framed or contained, whichever the case may be, becomes a huge problem. You know, communication, information, transportation systems have all advanced in our lifetimes from the, for some people, from the horse and buggy to where we are today. You know, some of the folks listening today remember when cars were a rare thing, telephones weren't around, and, you know, radio was the only way, and that was relatively new. You know, the idea that things have changed so dramatically, but people and our basic natures haven't, but we have these incredible technologies. In the United States, sort of the one of the major places, as well as Europe and the other advanced countries, where science is moving forward at faster and faster paces. You know, I was reading a publication, it's from June 30th, so it's just a few days old, and in this it was talking about the new supercomputers and what they can do. And we've talked about supercomputers in these programs over the past weeks. Supercomputers today can, the IBM Genie L can do 280.6 teraflops a second. You know, what does that, what does that mean to anybody? You know, teraflop, what is a teraflop? What this computer can do in 1 second is equal to all 6.6 billion people on the planet with hand calculators doing a calculation every 5 seconds for 60 hours. If everybody on the planet took a calculator for 60 hours and every 5 seconds ran a new set of calculations, in 60 hours you'd do what that computer can do in 1 second. Now that supercomputer is being used in one instance in Switzerland, and there's an article from earlier this in May this year where they're using it to analyze and create imaging of the brain itself, so where they can go and look at specific individual neurons firing in the brain or look at groupings of a few million neurons. And here's what's interesting about that. Think about that computing power in that computer for that 1 second. How much computing power, and all it can do is analyze what a few million neurons in a human brain can do. And a human brain has billions of neurons doing a lot more than that. In other words, we're more powerful as individuals, if we could ever figure out how to work with that circuitry, than maybe the biggest computers in the world times several thousand. That's pretty amazing. You know, when you think about computing power and this technology, another area where there's some just beginning to be some questions of the ethics of it, is this area of actually growing brain cells and neurons, which they've been able to do both. Brain cells and neurons, they've been able to grow on electronic substrate, so they can interface directly with electronic machines, computers, artificial appliances, you know, you name it. And so when you think about brain cell and brain capacity, and you think about it in terms of computing capacity, what is the ethics of growing brains with no soul connected to them that's used for computing? It's an interesting question, and it's one that, again, this generation is going to get to decide, because it's already happened. They've already been able to do it. Now it's a question of, can they make those biological circuits work independent of a person? And that's, and who knows how far that research has already gone. But the fact is, it's been going on. And this was has been the subject of my research the last couple of years, is looking at sort of what has happened in our understanding of human health and physiology that has allowed some of these new advances and some of the weapons technologies to move forward. And here's an interesting analogy or model. As you know, if you look at health sciences and you look at material science or the physics side of science, which deals with a lot more math and a lot more theory and a lot more understanding of sort of energy interactions that underlay chemical reactions, which underlay then, of course, manifestations within health. You know, when chemical reactions occur in the body, that's what most health practitioners look at. They don't look at what caused those changes underneath. So we've had, for decades, chemical models to explain what goes on in the body, and then they started to use what they called electrochemical models, where they said, hey, you know, the nervous system appears to transit current, so we know there's electricity there, so, you know, we got to deal with this issue. Then they decided later, well, wait a minute, you know, electric current always has a magnetic field, so there must be a magnetic component to this, too. People started looking at that. And then they began to look at the whole body in a whole new way, and this whole area of biophysics, the effect of energetic exchanges on living organisms, or what I call the frequency code, you know, that code of modulated or pulsed energy that resonates or harmonizes with the substance that causes what's called coupling. And during the course of the next hour, I want to get into that subject because it really starts to lay a framework for where a lot of technology is going. It at the same time will explain a lot of the technologies that we've reported on over the years. And, you know, where we think this thing is going in the long run, our technologies are being advanced that really have incredible possibilities for extending human potential or increasing human potential, or at the same time, if used incorrectly, doing exactly the opposite. And, you know, what's interesting is as the technology gets revealed, human potentials that we didn't think were possible all of a sudden start to show up. And I want to talk about, go back in time a bit and get into a guy by the name of George Estabrooks, who was one of the, he was a researcher at Harvard during the 1920s, eventually got his doctorate from Harvard, and he worked in primarily the area of psychology, physiology, and his specialty area and interest was hypnotism. And this is, you know, going back to the 20s, you know, this is a time when this was really just starting to be explored. And in the backdrop of a whole lot of changes going on in terms of the country's view of what was paranormal or unusual capacities of people. And this guy, Estabrooks, is an interesting character in terms of how he fits in. He died in 1973. He worked in the Harvard labs under some of the best in the business of hypnosis. And in the last 2 years, I've been researching this issue of controlling the human mind. And, of course, you've really got to start with this whole area of hypnosis, which gets you into the work of George Estabrooks. And Estabrooks was an academic all of his life. He wrote a number of books on the subject. He was considered an expert in the field, was a consultant to governments and to others. In fact, his work was classified in the mid-1930s, and he had some concepts that when he first fielded, he had this idea that using hypnosis you could create a super spy, and using hypnosis you could actually create a spy that wouldn't even know he or she was in that frame of mind, so to speak. And Estabrooks, as a hypnotist, trained and encouraged a lot of folks in this area. And I think it's one of those areas where, as we talk about George Estabrooks and what he did, he was doing this idea of splitting personalities deliberately, but he would do it covertly. In other words, he would get somebody to agree to work with him. And then the idea was to split or fracture the personality into two very distinct individuals. And I want to talk about that in the next hour. I want to wrap up, too, these subjects that we sort of opened with just because they were in the news. I want to make sure we got them covered on the sonars. And before I get into this issue with Estabrooks, I've got Paul in Delaware that's been hanging in, so I want to go ahead and take that call. Paul, are you still with me?
Actually, I'd like to speak on the mind control issue because I myself am a researcher in that area, and I've come to the conclusion that, yeah, that's the most important area. But I want to, before I do that, I want to speak about the caller. I heard a lot of, we are doing this, and we are doing this, and we're going to extend life. There's no life being going to be extended with all this technology, Doc. as you should know, that they are looking for exterminating 80-plus percent of the population. So whose life is going to be being extended with all this technology? Could it be the elites? And so I've heard a lot about what we are going to do. We aren't doing anything. A lot of people are nothing but abject slaves on this planet. And I'm just, when I listen to these radio shows, I'm like, are we ever going to get to the point where we actually start doing something about the problem?
Oh, hang in. The music's coming up. I got to go to the break, but we'll come back to you right after the break. Stay in with me, all right?
Sure.
All right, we're going to a break. We'll be right back. This is Dr. Nick Begich. Oh, okay, we're still on, I guess. We skipped that break.
Are we still on?
Yeah, go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I want to speak regarding the mind control issue. There's a lot of people, you're talking about fractured personalities.
Now I hear it coming up. I'm sorry, I just mistimed it. Apologize to everyone. We'll be right back. This is Dr. Nick Begich on Changing the Way We See the World, RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're talking about technology's impact on humanity. We're dealing with one specific issue in this hour. We're starting to get into this issue of applications of technology as it relates to manipulation of human beings. And we're starting with a discussion of hypnosis. And I've got Paul. You still on the line with me?
Yes.
Go ahead. You were saying something, I think, before the break.
Yeah, I was going to say that you have to want to believe, you'd have to want to get hypnotized. And I can tell you as I sit here, at least 90% of this country and probably the world is totally hypnotized and brainwashed. And when I say you've got to want to believe, I heard you say that many religions, first you said religions, then you said many religions. No, you're right. All the religions, every single last one of them, is a form of mind control. And, of course, you got to want to believe in an instance in Christianity that someone's going to come rapture you and take you out of this mess, or it's going to be better on the other side. But regarding mind control, there's many different aspects of it. When I say that 90%, we could talk about network marketing. We could talk about sports. We could talk about these people who think that psychics are talking to their dead relatives. We could talk about people who are brainwashed that America's the greatest country on earth. We could talk about people who believe that man has walked on the moon. We could talk about the brainwashing of the whole Nazi Germany society. We could talk about the brainwashing of secret societies. We could talk about many aspects. So that like 90%, as I sit here, we're talking about a discussion, but guess what? If this is so dangerous information, why are we sitting here just discussing it? Why aren't we taking action, or at least why aren't most people? I am about action. That's the difference, and I think that too many people are having armchair discussions, and out of all of this comes nothing. So it's more of the spectator sports and armchair discussion.
Paul, let's get into that, because I think that's the important point, and you're absolutely dead on right. I appreciate the call. Let me talk about what can be done, because I think that is where all this starts. You know, the idea of having this discussion, you know, what have we done in the last 2 years? Put together basically the 300 sources that irrefutably define what technologies are out there. And you know, what is the next step for us? It's to continue, a process of public education and connect that to enough of a political initiative to maybe make a difference on the way this technology is used. We've done it in the past. We're going to take it on this issue. I do consider it the most important issue that we're facing is how will technology be used to either free us or enslave us. And I want to go back for a minute to the issue of Estabrooks and what he was saying back in 1943 and then again in 1947. He figured out a way to fracture a personality so that they could go into the Soviet Union, for instance, in those days, and act as a spy and have absolutely no knowledge of who they formerly were. And, you know, and then they would come back, and then they would extract the intelligence from them, or they would give them their post-hypnotic suggestion in the Soviet Union or what have you. The problem with this type of technology, and he said it as well, is the reliability was limited, and the problems that stemmed from it were pretty much unimaginable. But these were the kinds of projects that when Estabrooks was doing most of his work, and one of the books that he wrote that I thought was pretty interesting, it was in 1961, it's called The Future of the Human Mind, and it's his forecast for where mind control technology was going. And, you know, where it's gone since that time is to technologies that actually can entrain by mapping the brain first and then sending signals back in that replicate signals that are relatively naturally produced. The problems and solutions that might be there are pretty interesting, but the misuse and abuse is also where most of the research, unfortunately, has been focused. I've got Jeff has been hanging on in Massachusetts for a while. Jeff, are you still there?
Oh, yes, I'm here. How's it going?
Good, good. Do you want to say something today or add in or ask a question?
Oh, yes. I want to talk about re-education camps because this has to do with mind control.
Okay, hold on. We're headed into a break. We'll bring you back right after the break. So hang in with me, Jeff. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And before I get back to Jeff, I'd like to give my website again is EarthPulse, EarthPulse, EarthPulse.com for articles and information on the subjects that we're covering today, and also for research material that we utilize in this program. You can look at Lay Institute, LayInstitute.org, LayInstitute.org. And Jeff, do I still have you on the line?
Oh, yes, sir, you do.
Okay, go ahead. You were just starting to get into something before the break. Go ahead and...
Oh, yes. Now, as far as re-education camps is concerned, that is the final straw before the ultimate dictatorship of America. Because, you see, first of all, I believe we're going to get hit with nuclear and biological weapons after we've been softened for the past 40 to 50 years. All this hypnosis, all these scalar waves hitting our country is softening our country to where we're going to be so stupid and dumb that when we get hit with a limited nuclear war, then they will put the patriot community into re-education camps to re-educate them in order to be a good little Bolshevik. To be a good little Bolshevik, you must do as you're told and believe whatever we tell you for that particular day. If the Bolsheviks tell you that man and a cat can get married on Tuesday and a man and a woman can get married on Wednesday, then one is a good candidate to be a good Bolshevik.
Well, Jeff, I appreciate the call, and I think you are right in terms of, you know, how things work in the long run. You know, when you look at the philosophy behind the governments that we've really invested huge amounts of U.S. capital, U.S. political capital, as well as cash and Western cash, and you look at their ideology, it certainly doesn't line up with most free-thinking people. I mean, think about China's industrial complex that has been built on American technology, and now we have this possibility that they'll surpass us and maybe already have in some areas of technological development. You know, when you have a centralized government and a billion people to pick from, you can bring your best minds into the frame of research that you want them most suited to, and the possibilities have changed dramatically. And the Chinese take a 40-year, 50-year view of the world. And if you look at the history of China, when they won their revolution in the 40s, they applied a principle that was old. It was called the Art of War by Sun Tzu. It's taught in every military academy in the world as the way in which you win wars. And their application of those same principles in the economic war that they launched against us with the Nixon administration in the early 70s has, in fact, already been won. I mean, their productive capacity and the revolution in industrial revolution taking place there dwarfs what has ever happened anywhere on the planet, to the point where fuel costs, commodities costs of every kind, and inflation is being fueled in the West as our dollars are being exported to the East and to the Middle East, where our economy could be crushed by just a flood of dollars rolling back our direction. And one day it will, because ultimately it's not about the bucks and the money for the Chinese. It's using our own system against us. That's the art of war. It's what they've learned to do quite effectively, and we're watching it play out again. You know, the idea of, again, you know, communism works against the individual and squishes everybody into this collective, which we're seeing more and more reflected in the West in any case, you know, pushed into some collective. And, you know, the last caller before you, Jeff, had commented on all religions being basically corrupt and bankrupt. And, you know, maybe they are, but I believe one thing for sure is that a couple thousand years ago, a guy showed up to say, hey, we had greater potential than we even recognize. and hang on, you know, but recognize your birthright. And I think that's the essence of it, that whether it's the elites of the world who've withheld knowledge or whether it's the governments of the world who continue to do it and abuse knowledge where it works against humanity, this is what has to be ripped open and seen. And the technologies of today have the power to enslave or free. And the philosophy behind that power in both the East and the West has been corrupted, and humanity and people have been forgotten. And that's what has to change, whether it's multinational corporations driving our political institutions of the West, or whether it's communist clubs of the East, or some other philosophy that isn't about freedom and isn't about liberty. And I think that's where, again, these technologies today that exist today and are advancing dramatically and rapidly have to begin to be addressed by free people. And the way we can do it is first by conversation, but secondly by political action, as the last caller said. Engage the process. Don't let these politicians get away. Whatever issue that is important to each of us, just do something about it and recognize you're not alone. There's billions of others doing the same thing.
No, you are absolutely right. And let me add to this, which is the concept of hypnosis. The caller is right. A lot of people will not go along with hypnosis, but you combine drugs, starvation, and a good concentration camp, and you can literally bend
yeah.
and break the mind with scalar wave technology.
Yeah.
Scalar waves? Yes.
I want to mention that because you've mentioned it twice. And, you know, this technology of being able to affect people over large geographic areas is the subject of the book we just finished, and it's called Controlling the Human Mind. It'll be out in about 4 weeks. This text shows clearly how you can oscillate or you can resonate the entire geomagnetic field of the planet and to carry a signal. In other words, it has its own sort of carrier rhythm, if you will. But you can piggyback on any energy source a signal that is unique. In other words, you can dial in like dialing in a radio station, as many people did today to hear this broadcast. You can dial in any element, any compound, any group of cells, anything really that the body can do, you can replicate externally and then create external signals the body will recognize as those nerve impulses or natural signals going through the body, yet they're artificially created. This is where the work in Switzerland in the last hour I was mentioning is going when they start to look at the brain. But the brain of people, as I mentioned in that last hour, in 1 second, the biggest computer in the world can do what everybody on the planet can do with a hand calculator for 60 hours, running a calculation every 5 seconds, 6.6 billion people. Doing it all for 60 hours, you get 1 second of the supercomputer, and that supercomputer is only capable of looking at a few million interactions in the human brain versus what goes on in the human brain. In other words, every human brain has more potential by several thousand times than that, and we don't plug into that. We don't know how to yet, but that is changing. And this is, again, when you go back to what our potentials are, what are our birthrights as human beings, and you see these anomalous things throughout history and throughout time being researched in scientific labs in the last 100 years to figure out the frequency codes, the energy codes that underlie these things. In fact, when you talk about mass hypnosis, you can look at a television set. Television is considered to be harmless. You know, the light emitted from a TV is supposed to be harmless, yet December 17th, 1997, MSNBC and others released a story in Japan on 700 kids, just under 700 kids going to the hospital with epileptic seizures from watching a cartoon, Pokemon, on TV. And what had happened is the flicker rate, the rate of the pulse of that light signal was such that it locked onto the brains of those individuals and triggered those chemical reactions. You can manipulate with knowledge, advertising, and put people in a very suggestive state during that 30-second or 60-second advertisement, making people more likely to buy a product. Plus the whole condition of watching television, if you look at brain activity, you become more suggestive just by the very act itself. You're passively absorbing information, and if people use that, the knowledge that is existing today about how to oscillate a frequency to get the brain even into a more suggestive state, they can apply that to television advertising, and there's no restriction in law about it on the books today?
Two words that confirms everything you said. Subliminal advertising. Now, the long and short of it is that I don't watch too much TV, and I listen to shortwave radio, read books, and that kind of stuff. And you see, I really believe that America is turning into a third world country, and we are losing our edge, and we are giving that edge over to the Russians and to the Chinese by traitors in this country, and that's it, plain and simple.
Jeff, yes. I appreciate the call,
yes.
And I want to get into this issue again, because in the long run, you're exactly right. It's people doing things for economic interests that really work against the human interests that Americans share in common as individuals who love freedom and liberty. And, you know, when you look at the rest of the world, you know, when I travel around the world, I meet people just like you and me feeling exactly the same things, feeling exactly the same kind of oppression from governments that come at them rather than lift them up in a way that this country's tradition once was. You know, government wasn't there to trample over people, and that's what it does today. And it's up to us to reengage. And, you know, the thing that government fears the most is what they call spontaneous revolution. I'm not talking about violence or people in the streets. I'm talking about the idea that when people start to recognize what the potentials are and act on them in unison, great things happen and huge things change. And I think that's a direction that we need to go. You know, what I had heard from one of the callers today was this mindset of just wait for the next rapture. Well, you know what? We're not called to wait for a rapture. We're called to engage in life and be stewards of this planet and be responsible and be accountable for a greater calling than the one that we're all settling for. And that's this idea of being oppressed and victims. We're not victims. We need to start acting as the empowered people our founding fathers intended every individual in this country to be, and begin to engage the process and not let these slippery politicians slide out from under accountability. But let's start insisting on the accountability that will change this country back to what it once was. We're headed into the break. Jeff, thanks for your call. For other callers, the number is 800-313-9443. And this is Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're on RVN Live, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And we're talking about technology issues. Started out with a discussion about sonars in the last hour and went into some of the technologies that are going to affect human life dramatically over the next few years, and had quite a bit of interest in those subjects. This is, again, 800-313-9443 if you want to get in on the conversation today. You know, this idea of artificially being able to affect by external energy sources things within our health and physiology, what's called electromedicine in terms of health. In psychology, they're using methods of neurobiofeedback, brain biofeedback. They're using technologies that have created the ability to exploit what is called FFR, or frequency following response. And what this is the natural tendency. In fact, you cannot resist it. It's just an absolute requirement. The brain will lock on to external oscillating signals within certain ranges. It'll couple with them and actually begin to move in very different patterns, which then change chemical reactions within the brain and affect all of the processes that come from it. What is being learned about the brain using three-dimensional MIRs now that actually give you a three-dimensional image, so you can look at, for instance, pain centers when a person is experiencing chronic pain. You know, presently, the way we address that is with pharmaceuticals. I mean, pharma has been the answer for treating all of the various symptoms, but when you really look at pain in terms of pain centers within the brain, some things were done a number of years ago to block the transmission, for instance, of the nerve impulses, and devices called TENS, T-E-N-S, machines were developed. And these produced sort of a blocking action that would keep the pain from migrating through the nervous system so it would never reach the brain. And, you know, there was good and bad to that because, you know, then people didn't feel the pain. They tend to overexert. The same is true with pharma. Pharmacology solutions, but those solutions lead to addictions. They lead to liver, kidney problems often, or other digestive tract disorders or other disorders in terms of side effects. The using TENS machines, they were able to block. But here's what they're doing with three-dimensional imaging, what it offers in potential for brain biofeedback and neurobiofeedback. If you can isolate, and they can now, down to one neuron, the firing of neurons related to pain impulses, you can learn through training how to turn those impulses off on your own. You get the feedback by watching the computer screen. And they do this for a number of different disorders now. They're doing it for not using three-dimensional imaging, but things much, much cruder than that, but sufficient, for instance, for training kids with ADHD, attention deficit disorders of various kinds, hyperactivity, brain disorders and brain injuries are being repaired, or there's been significant progress on sort of rerouting what the brain is doing so people regain faculties. They're using it in drug addiction for alcoholics and drug addictions, again, for controlling those portions of the brain that otherwise lead to those kinds of outcomes. And here's what's interesting about neurobiofeedback. What's being learned is that human beings, like riding a bicycle, can learn to modulate their brain activity into these ideal states of learning or activity. Think about that for a moment and what potential is unleashed in that if just the average person could focus their attention when they needed to, de-stress when they need to, in other words, relax at will without having all the anxiety. And think about the biggest thing in America right now is anxiety-related medications and stress-related illnesses, whether they be psychological or physiological in our bodies. And the things that are happening now in this area of science in terms of electromedicine and the idea of using what's being learned about the brain for changing the way in which our brains operate in a positive and greater potential. You know, our schools do this now, but they do it in the wrong direction. You know, when kids start out in elementary school at their very early ages, first we start them way too early in the United States. Brain development and the prominent brain activity, if you look at it, and researchers have, it's not developed enough for the academic kind of learning that we start to shove on kids at 5 and 6 years old. Academic learning, the brain isn't really ready for until around 7 when Europeans begin to educate. Before then, kids are engaged in Europe, and they should be in the U.S., in activities that gain social skills, language, because the portions of the brain that have been most developed are really oriented between the age of, say, 3 or 4 and 6 and 7. For that kind of learning. That's where they learn language, social skills, how to behave, all those kinds of things that you want kids to learn before we start the academics. And when you look at brain activity in young children, you'll see both hemispheres, both sides of the brain tend to be very well balanced or more balanced than in adults. And then as we educate kids or so-called educate kids, we historically would push them into certain cues. So In young girls, for instance, the creative side of the brain would develop, and in young boys, the analytical side would be developed. And this was a lot of environmental conditioning, and, you know, that's changed, too, because since the 80s, we start to see everyone developing this analytical side at the expense of the creative as we sort of equalize the injustice in the system, because the reality is both sides of the brain are intended to work together, the creative and the analytical. That's where you get the great synergies of human potentials, and that's what we're missing, is the use of the whole brain. We're headed to a break. I want to get into this topic some more because it's really on the solution side. How do we increase our potentials, get rid of our stress so we can once again engage in the life of liberty and pursuit of happiness? Take that and give that back to us. That's what this century should be about. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we've been talking about technologies today, the subject every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. We're talking about technology subjects. We'll try and cover what's breaking in the news as it relates to some of our research areas when we come to you, as well as cover some of the issues that you know, are I think the biggest issues, you know, technology is, in fact, what is going to make the 21st century different from anything else we've ever seen. You know, the last century was pretty remarkable. You know, just kind of go back. I was with my aunt the other day. She's 83, and you know, we were talking about her dad, my grandfather, and going back and looking at what he experienced, you know, going from literally the horse and buggy. You know, he was born in 1890. I remember as a kid talking with him and about sort of what had happened. And think about it. You used to want to communicate with someone. You sent them a letter and hoped it would get through, or you wandered around town until you ran into them. You know, you didn't have telephones. You didn't have radio. You didn't have TV. We didn't have the Internet. We didn't have we had libraries, but very few of them. We had limited education systems in terms of what the average person was accessible to them. We didn't even have public education until the 20s. The fact is, all of that first 150 years, we did, you know, pretty darn good as a group of individuals deciding the fate of our nation. And I think, you know, today we have even more education, more knowledge than we've ever had before, and a population that certainly could do a better job. And it's a lot of it is this idea of we've been beaten down, you know, we've been beat up. And I agree with that. You know, the whole system comes at you. You know, we thought in the 60s that this, by now, we would have what was called back then the leisure generation. You know, can anybody even imagine what that is in 2006? I mean, it was supposed to be down to, you know, the 25-hour work week and all kinds of time to pursue our interests and build a great, incredible democracy. But instead, the opposite has happened. In fact, we look more like slaves than free than we ever did before. Working two and three jobs in a household to make ends meet and to make it work, and now being told, hey, don't worry, you know, all our lives being reassured that the things we were buying into were things that were reasonable and solid, to find out now that not just Social Security's in jeopardy, but every retirement system almost on the planet is in jeopardy because of the way things have worked. You know, things have worked against the average person. You know, the old democratic principles of that we all shared in common have been lost. And every year, and we're getting into this year again, the political season where we're all pitted against one another on the social issues, and they start to eat our attitudes and time. Well, the big issues, the ones that are going to affect us every month, energy issues and energy policy, economic issues when we start to see the double-digit inflation right after these elections are over. And what we're going to get is the same old rhetoric from most of the politicians, and we need to start finding those mavericks. You know, today people say, oh, nobody cares, nobody votes, you know, 20% only show up at the polls. Hooray! You only have to convince 10% plus one that you're right and get them to show up. It's a lot easier than 51%. The point of the matter is we can't give up. You know, we need to take on the issues that are important to each of us, and we all have our own agenda, and a simple thing we can all do. You know, you can put that issue on a piece of paper and put it in where you put your bills and think of something that you can do for 10 minutes. So when you're doing that miserable experience of writing those bills out to pay for this leisure society we never saw, think about that political action that you can put 10 minutes into. And maybe it's sending an email to a few friends and telling them about the programs on RBN Live, or maybe it's writing a handwritten letter to a congressman, because that still does really matter. It matters a lot. The fact is, we can still do some things. Let's not give up on what's possible. Let's start to look at what is possible and shake this this spirit of fear that our government keeps shoving down our throat, and recognize that we don't have to be afraid. We have to be bold enough to step into the action that we're each called to do. And I've got Beth in California hanging in there with me for a while. So, Beth, are you still there? Beth, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. There you are.
Hi. Hey, that was a great message of hope you just gave. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I called in to make two points, and they are related. The first point is that in all the radio frequencies and acoustic subliminals and things that have been discussed on your show today and at other times, I'm aware that all of the sensors that the government is developing for the civilian sector covers everything, like biological agents, radioactivity, explosive devices, but not one of them that they put out for contract or actually have in place covers radio frequencies. And
there is a contract that's out, and it's an open solicitation, and it's actually by the Electromagnetic Directorate of the Air Force, and it's one that I quote in the book that we just finished, and it'll be out in a few weeks. But this open RFP, which is a request for proposals, opened a year or so ago, and has been and it remains open until 2009, and is actively looking specifically for those answers. And as I'm talking to you, I'm going to look up the citation because it was really a powerful statement. When it, you know, in terms of the bottom line, what are they really looking for? You know, because a lot of times, a lot of these RFPs aren't so clear. You know, and today you're seeing a lot more bold RFPs coming through. And as we're talking, I'm kind of flipping through my latest files because I know I have it in here. And this whole issue, you know, this whole issue has really generated more controversy than it has, you know, solutions, but not in the right quarters. You know, people aren't having the debate where they need to have it, which is really in the Congress. And when you start to look at the RFPs or even putting out, I can't lay my hands on it, but it's maybe during the break I'll find it. But this this idea that the government is actually actively seeking it for specifically to control what they're calling within the Air Force controlled effects, and that covers everything from hardware to biological effects. And in the biological area, what they're trying to do is find out all of those energy interactions that can interact with our health and physiology so they can either flip it on or flip it off, just like a light switch. And that's this is a bold set of initiatives that aren't operating in a vacuum, but there's several branches. There's even an organization called the Directed Energy Professional Society. They're meeting for their ninth time on October 30th. This year, and it's run by the Air Force Research Laboratory's Directed Energy Directorate, and it covers not just lasers and those kinds of things, but all of these exotic technologies.
I can't wait for your book to come out.
Well, you know, it's one of those we spent 2 years researching, and even up until the last few days, you know, we were adding additional citations because we get them from time to time. Some of them are extremely compelling, and you know, when you start to see them collected together, that's where everything kind of it makes sense, because then you can start to see where the national policy has gone, sort of how the debate's been skirted, and at the same time get the full implications of what's coming. And that, I think, is, you know, and a lot of what we try and do on this program is at least find that information, root it out, and get it out to people. In fact, here's the RFP, and it's the and I'll read you the one-liner at the bottom that really says it. The ultimate goal of such research is to develop a fully articulated theory with supporting predictive models that will facilitate the inducement of desired behavioral effects in individuals and groups through the use of non-lethal weapons, unquote. Yeah. And that is their, it's from the research, or the federal agency name is the Air Force Research Lab, and it's broad agency announcement BAA05-05-HE. And it's, you know, been filed in the Federal Register, and, you know, it's out there. And these are, these proposals that go out, the RFPs, aren't written in a vacuum. They're written because they've already been presented enough basic information to say it's out there. Now we need to ask for it so the companies that have it can come forward and meet the bidding requirements of the federal government and develop the technology.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a whole area. I didn't know about that. Most people don't. And, I mean, it is absolutely profound. There's going to be a big change when that starts moving. And the last comment that I was going to mention was, you know, a lot of people have been concerned about having shielding against this type of manipulation. And I wanted to present a different option and wondering what you think the possibilities are.
Right.
If other people can have this impact on our brains and central nervous systems and our entire biological systems, why can't an individual have their own rebalancing personalized technology? There's a company that makes a product called an Accuscope, and interestingly enough, in order to get FDA approval, they paired it with a TENS unit that you had just commented on previously in your program.
Right.
And without going into all the science behind it, because I don't want to misrepresent it and I'm not that clear about it, it actually does personalized in some way. It changes. You can adjust your brain waves through an FDA-approved.
Absolutely. Yeah. That technology is there. You can use. I'll tell you, we break it down because we deal with both sides of this issue. We deal with the military side and the enhancing human performance side of the issue in the book we've just finished. But you can use any number of brain entrainment effects. You can use electrocranial stimulation, which is using electromagnetic fields that pulse. Mm-hmm. You can use light. You can use sound. You can use a radio broadcast that can carry a modulation. You can use the power grid that you can embed a modulation on that will affect certain components of the body as efficiently as dialing a radio station. When you get resonance harmony between the receiver and the sender, then you get an action. And in the body, what you have is the body is triggered by codes that are not just the chemical codes that everybody talks about. You know, in the chemistry break, when you break down the food into its relevant constituents and the body absorbs the proper molecules in the proper places and reconstruct the body and the cells and the nerves and all the parts of the body, and it knows what to grab and when to grab it. You know, those are all the chemical codes of the body, but underlying those are the frequency codes, the energy codes that drive those processes. And this is what they've learned to dial into for negative effects as well as positive health effects. And this is the revolution that we're going to see in medical science and in all sciences, because understanding the energy interactions in the human body is going to change our view of all the technologies around us and our own potentials to solve our own problems. And this is where, for me, the big excitement is. And right now we have a government and many governments in the world today spending billions to take away that potential by suppressing the knowledge that frees us and using it essentially to create weapon systems.
Right. And somehow, if we as individuals can have access to that, those the new MRIs, all those things that we can learn, what is our best and original natural self, and be able to counteract whatever environmental or external influences are by knowing that for ourselves and just realigning, recalibrating ourselves on a regular basis and be free.
Yeah, absolutely. And these things are, you know, I think they're already out there, the technologies. A lot of these things are already out there in terms of availability. Take a look for some indications. You can even look at our website at earthpulse.com. We've got some hardware there that's pretty
I saw that. I was very interested in that.
And, you
thank
know, just,
you so much for
hey,
your program and information. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, and pass it on. And remember, these shows are archived so people can look at them. You know, make copies, get them out to folks. It's information we certainly want out there. And I've got Marilyn hanging in California. You're still there, Marilyn?
Hi, I've got a question that's kind of off the subject a little bit, but I noticed today on the Internet that all of a sudden Ken Lay of Enron has just died from sudden heart failure. Sort of reminds me of Milosevic just dying all of a sudden. Is he of any relation to this Lay Institute?
Not at all. There's no relation whatsoever. The Institute was set up, our Institute was set up by Dorothy Lay, who is one of the heirs of Herman Lay, who founded Lay Potato Chips, later merged it with Frito, and then...
Oh, Frito-Lay.
That's right. And then eventually became the chairman of PepsiCo when he merged it there. And Dorothy has had an interest in technology issues and has followed our work for years. And just about 2 years ago, she asked me to be on her board and serve as her executive director, which I've been doing the last couple of years, to really educate the public on technologies. If you look at the layinstitute.org site, you'll see the goals. It's filed as a 501c3. We're still waiting for our IRS approval, but it is incorporated in Texas as a nonprofit. And the idea is to really educate the public on technologies, their potential impacts, and create the kinds of institutions that maybe can address it in the future. And we're really in the very beginnings of that. The first effort was the website to get public information, really more public, get it out there where people can see it. And then from there, we've got a number of projects planned for the coming years.
Well, I think I'm glad you're doing that. Do you feel that... I've got a chance to answer a question in a large paper about the government using databases to track banking records. My feeling is this has been done for years.
It has. It has. We have a book out. It was published in January of 2000 called Earth Rising to Revelation, which gets into the SynFin system as well as the other financial systems.
Wait, what's
that
have been called
used. SynFin, C-I-N-F-I-N, I believe. I might be wrong on that, but you can see it in the book Earth Rising the Revolution. And Earth Rising the Revolution has 650 referenced sources in the book, so it's one of the most heavily referenced. It gets into the whole personal privacy issue, gets into these technologies, and they were around in the 90s and have been used consistently since then. What you're seeing in the mainstream is because now the violations are even more flagrant than they were in the past. You get a little bit of news blip, but go back to that original book, and all these companies that have lost your credit card records, all of these outfits that are now releasing information, we disclosed over 7 years ago the game plan and cited the patents, the academic papers, and their own stock reports to tell you where these people were headed, and we're there, and we're going there more rapidly now than ever before. The book Earth Rising 2 we brought out right after 9/11 to really talk more about sort of where it's gone from there. And, you know, again, 350 sources in that book on privacy-related and other technologies advancing right now. And, you know, we can't get fearful of all this, but what we do need to do is begin to recognize that this is our country. We need to start to take it back to the extent that we can, and it doesn't take a lot to do that. It just requires a little bit of effort on the part of a lot of people, and it's really just a little bit of effort on the part of a lot of people that'll make a difference.
Thanks for your work, Dr. Baggage. I'm listening again to you.
Well, thanks, and I appreciate you being here today. And, you know, people that are listening to this program, if it's useful to you, please pass the word on. Get other folks dialed into RBN. There's a lot of good programming on the network, and, you know, we're pleased to be a part of it. We're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m., we're going to be covering technology issues, you know, on into the future. You know, there's no shortage of information, and we'll try and bring it together and create the kind of lively discussion, at least, that maybe takes us down a little bit different path. You know, these technologies can serve the causes of liberty and the causes of freedom. I mean, what greater thing than to reach our highest and best potential, something that our founding fathers actually believed in and something we can actually grab hold of again today. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we're getting into the last segment before we're off for this week. We'll be back again next week, however, at 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. I'm not sure what we're going to talk about next week, but we'll be definitely covering some issues in technology. We'll see where it goes. You know, this issue of technology areas we've covered. This issue of the mind control technology has come up often, you know, in lots of different forums. And, you know, when we first started looking at this issue years ago, you know, the data was really tough to sort out, tough to analyze and understand, you know, because you're dealing with a number of disciplines. In fact, you know, just to go back to how we got involved in this story, you know, back when I was 19 years old in 1978, I was in a conference, and I met a gentleman, an electrophysiologist, Dr. Reho Mikaela, brilliant guy from Finland. At the time, he was working in Australia. And, you know, when I remember back on the conversations we had in his research of the 70s, which now 30 years later is starting to make it into the mainstream, and at that time, after having met him, I just didn't have the education. I didn't have the knowledge to translate what he was telling me, you know, to understand it completely. I mean, you could get the idea, you know, like often you do when you're talking about complicated subjects. You get the concept, but you don't really understand the mechanics. It took me 30 years to study that mechanics and look across the disciplines and get to the point where I could articulate it in a way that's understandable. I mean, to me, where it means I understand it, I know it, I can teach it to someone else. And in that, the writing that we've done over the years has been about that. And this latest work, Controlling the Human Mind, both for detrimental applications, but more importantly for increasing human performance, is really the result. You know, we're going to have that out in about 4 weeks. It's going to get into these issues a lot further, a lot faster. And already we're working on the sequel. And it's a book that we're going to actually deliver a lot more information on empowering people by being able to be unleashed to our own potentials by recognizing some of the things that we can do that are out there right now, both in terms of our physical health as well as our mental health that don't require the pharmacology solutions that have been thrown at us, both from the establishment as well as the anti-establishment. I mean, that's the solution of choice, it seems like, one way or the other for way too many. And what is that about? It's about snuffing out our human potential. It's about shutting off our sensory inputs instead of amplifying them in the way that God intended. And that means we individually control what happens with our lives, not some external force. And I think we can learn to do that better. We can use the same kinds of advances in technologies that have taken humanity to many good places. But it's the will of man. It's the intent of human beings that will determine whether the technologies are used to enhance our existence on this planet or to suppress it. And, you know, the technologies that we have available today have the potential to free us even to greater extents, economically, socially, and politically. And, you know, we need to learn how to do that and how to restructure the systems that are in front of us so that they support the idea of abundance and not scarcity, of people with a birthright to claim much greater abundance on this planet than what we're claiming today, and not in a way that destroys the very place that we live. You know, as stewards, as caretakers, we have great potential. And, you know, this show's about technology that'll take us in the 21st century to new places. You've been listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and we'll be back next Wednesday.